Welcome to the 30th episode of Advanced Map Radio. I'm Toby Chat.
I'm Andy Ryan.
It's a one-off game, but I think we're going to keep it pretty light-hearted if we can stay awake. That was Gary Kirsten, ahead of South Africa's first 2020 against India. And on this podcast, we're always light-hearted, and just occasionally we manage to keep our audience awake.
And there was very little light-hearted about England's comeback in Sri Lanka after a sort of pretty miserable time of it in Pakistan.
There was something of relief. I think Andrew Strauss certainly will have a
significant feeling. It felt really strange, wouldn't it, to have journalists actually seriously discussing Strauss's future as a Test captain. You know, it's so shortly after the Ashes heroics, it just, you know, a real sign of how the game's changed. But I mean, what was it for you that was particularly sort of satisfying about that second test?
Well, we were going to record this episode a week ago, and at that stage it was before the second test, and I had prepared a little piece about how England really needed to learn how to bat as a unit, and all of the batsmen to actually sort of see what their place was in relation to one another, because actually I think a lot of their failing in the past has come from the fact that they've all tried to sort of bat in the same way, really. And what was really satisfying in the second test is the way that Cook and Strauss and Trott went out and said, OK, we just need to lay some foundations. And they, you know, the most remarkably turgid batting display, but fantastic for it. Going out scoring runs at far fewer than, you know, a run every two balls.
It's interesting, though, isn't it? Because we know that Cook and Trott were sort of are capable of that. You know, we've seen them do that before. I mean, is there some frustration, surely, that this didn't come together before the Pakistan series?
I think they sort of felt that they, against Pakistan, they felt that they had to be the aggressors, I think, essentially. And they need to be the kind of Matthew Haydens at the beginning of the innings, was the impression I got, particularly when faced with, you know, they all thought, you know, so faced with a spinner like Ajmal, we have to sort of hit him off his length straight away. Mm. Whereas, in fact, they suddenly turned around, it seemed, in the second test against Sri Lanka and said, actually, you know, Peterson can come in and do that, but in order for us to get to that stage, we have to have laid some groundwork first.
Mm. I mean, that certainly, Peterson's innings was definitely one of the most exciting things about the second test.
And Peterson's been in the news for other reasons as well.
Yeah, I mean, certainly in terms of what has upset me most recently, I love Kevin Peterson, the batsman, one of those batsmen very much worth the entrance fee alone. But Kevin Peterson, the sort of human being, consistently kind of frustrates and upsets. His comments about the IPL the other day, saying he found it sad that England hadn't accepted the game. He put it down to jealousy. And I felt like, I mean, you're just treating the fans like idiots. I mean, you've got to accept that these are people who know the game well, love the game, and actually there are lots of very legitimate reasons for not liking the IPL, as both of us, I'm sure, would argue for.
And particularly when it came on the back of an article by Lawrence Booth in Wisden, and actually that's someone who isn't really acting on just sort of the petulant jealousy of not being able to see an IPL match in London.
I mean, I think there was another side to this, which I think said a lot about what is wrong with current sort of sports journalism, that you went to the Cricinfo homepage and Kevin Peterson's comments were the news story.
Yep.
And I think something's really frustrating when you have a game, some great county games going on, you have a game between Australia and West Indies, and yet you're talking about what Kevin Peterson said. It does seem to be some mismatch
and
priorities.
Actually, that game between West Indies and Australia has been a pretty exciting one in itself, hasn't it?
Well, I think it's been my highlight. I will accept that my most unhealthy cricketing addiction is predicting a West Indies revival. Yeah. I think I do so kind of almost on a sort of two-three monthly basis.
You were completely unstoppable after that West Indies England series when the West Indies were before we were podcasting that was, but dear listeners, I can tell you he was bouncing up and down for weeks on end.
But like a kind of sort of failed, you know, one of those fanatics who predicts the end of the world and is repeatedly proved wrong, I'm going to predict it again because I do feel like things are different this time.
What's different?
I feel like Otis Gibson, Darren Sammy there's a real plan at work here. They've been willing to discard a lot of cricketers, although not crucially Shiv Chanderpaul. They've backed the young cricketers and they've really brought in a kind of work ethic that I think has been missing for a while. I mean, it seems odd to be predicting a turnaround that they've drawn a one-day series and they've lost that first test. Yeah. But what was so encouraging was they were competitive throughout. And I think what's been sad in recent years, I mean, it's become such a cliche, you know, Test cricket needs a strong West Indies. But it's more than that. I mean, it's actually, West Indies have been humiliatingly bad for such a long time. It's not just that they haven't been, they've just been really awful.
Their resilience in batting at the the beginning of the last test against Australia was amazing when they batted for nearly 2 days.
Craig Braithwaite.
Very impressive.
And I suppose, as a cynic, and I love Shiv Chanderpool as well, great player. I mean, he was vital in that first inning. So you could say, well, is that really a sign of a turnaround? There were lots of young batsmen contributing as well.
I think you're exactly right. That this is what's different about this series, is that it's not, you know, the same old players who occasionally play well. It's actually bringing through a whole new generation. But there's a sense of a bit of a clean start, I think.
Now, we're excited about a trip in a couple of weeks down to Hove to see Sussex play that same touring West Indian side.
And we'll tell you all about it. You'll hear all about it here first.
We've picked up tickets for a bargain-busting £10.
Including a beer festival.
including a beer and rum festival. Yeah. I know. I feel like we're doing an advertising promotion here for Sussex.
And so this morning, having gone on books all of that, I got enthused and I went onto the Lord's website and I thought, well, I'll just book all my cricket for the summer now. And actually, it was all a bit of a disappointment. Not only because there was quite a lot that was already sold out. That's not a disappointment. That's to be expected, really, and that's a good thing, undoubtedly. But simply the fact that, A, the ticket prices are high at Lord's, and B, the way that they work their ballots for their big matches, and I'm thinking particularly the South Africa match this summer, rewards frequent attenders. And in a sense, that's all very well and good, and it's a wonderful thing that in England we can sell out test grounds. Partly it's because we have such small test grounds, but it's certainly a good thing that there is that core following. But if the ECB and Lords and the MCC are going to be spending all this money on marketing and promoting the game more widely, then it seems a pity to me to then be so penny-pinching when it comes to insisting that revenue on the gate should be as high as possible, because that is a complete killer for actually broadening participation.
It's a really interesting one, because I think, as you say, there is this attempt to sort of spread the popularity of the game, and yet you could it would be so much better to invest the money in cutting those prices, getting people in. I mean, I think what's particularly interesting now is if watching England would ever be popular, it's going to be really popular now. You have a team that's so successful, got some quite charismatic players, charismatic figures. And I mean, it is really sad that there's not more of an attempt. I mean, you know, it was minimum price of £70 to watch a test match. Is pretty prohibitive, sort of, many people.
And I think what it does is it encourages the people who are willing to, who are both able and willing to fork out, who are often the people who go every year, to be able to do it. Whereas it doesn't encourage people who are just going to try it out. And actually, watching test cricket, the thrill of watching test cricket is second to none in terms of getting people into the game and getting people addicted to the game. And, you know, counties have got the right idea. Yes, obviously they can't. They don't have as broad a reach, so they can't charge to the £70. But the reason they charge low prices is because they say, okay, we need to be able to get people through the gate in the first place. And it's just disappointing that some test grounds seem to be slightly abusing their position to just take as much money as possible.
From the archives, and this week we have a real treat for you. Toby is going to be giving us a history of one of cricket's most unloved and yet somehow very vital objects, the box.
But it's interesting that we call it the box, which sort of says immediately one of the main points about it, which is that we never actually really talk about boxes, abdominal protectors, groin protectors, as it was known in 1890. It's always referred to euphemistically, and as such, it's actually quite difficult to sort of look at a history of it. And actually, the history of the box is hugely tied up with social history as well, and the way that people feel or don't feel comfortable about talking about the groin area.
I love how we've gone from abdominal protectors to social history in a matter of lines.
It's one of those, because it's one of those things that it's, the box is completely unseen, but it's talked about all the time. It's no one ever shares their box with anyone else. It's completely unbranded. It's in the 21st century, it is the only piece of cricket kit that is... Well, actually, I don't know. I've never seen Shiv Chanderpool's box. But I imagine that it's completely unbranded, because there would be, you know, it's a completely hidden piece of kit. And in the memorabilia-obsessed world that we have, where you can buy sort of Don Bradman's inners or something like that, you boxes never, ever appear, which in itself is probably for the best. the first mention of a box in a sort of commercial cricketing context came in 1855. Lillywhite's private guard, as it was advertised. But again,
that just sounds like, as you said, with euphemisms, that again sounds slightly dubious, doesn't it?
Exactly.
Your private guard.
There's suspicion that in the early 1800s, the Reverend James Pycroft, in his book The Cricket Field, was referring to a private guard when he described a crossbar India rubber guard. Now, one could protect any part of one's body with a crossbar India rubber guard, I'd imagine. So it's completely this problem of actually, you know, distinguishing what is a box and what isn't when you look back through the archives. This is really a sign, I think, of Victorian prudishness and the fact that you don't sort of openly acknowledge the fact that you require a box or anything needs protecting.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I don't want to be... you think about other sports as well, and you think about, actually, there's not really, I think if I'm right, an obvious precedent for it, is there?
No.
I don't think other sports, despite, you know, protecting an area that is vital and, you know, close to the heart of many, not literally, God, that was, what a terrible choice of words.
But it
doesn't seem to have a precedent in other sports.
No, it doesn't. And actually, it's kind of, descriptions of it veer between the sort of private guard, the incredibly euphemistic, and then in 1890, suddenly, the box has its day, and you get Palmer's patented groin protector, which I think is just fantastic, the idea of a patented groin protector.
Do we have any idea what this was or looked like? I mean, what do we have any sense of what
there
kind of a contraption?
Well, when it was originally made out of rubber, and the problem with rubber is that it's either you can have stiff rubber or flexible rubber, and flexible rubber basically does nothing. It's just like having another layer in order to another layer of clothing, and stiff rubber doesn't break. It's incredibly hard, and so apparently it would just jam the box into the area around what it was trying to.
This is
the problem we have when describing boxes. You inevitably fall into euphemism for our family-friendly racing. But essentially, you'd end up with the groin protector embedded into your groin if it. And now boxes nowadays, of course, are designed to break on impact, like motorcycle helmets or something like that, to kind of take the impact and break with it. During the 19th century, you get an evolution from something that's kind of there in the background and everyone realises is necessary, towards something that's sort of part of cricket kit. And that really was in 1890, when we get to Palmer's patented groin protector, seems to be the moment which kind of solidifies the idea of the modern box, to the extent that nowadays ECB directives talk about having an abdominal protector as a normal item of protective equipment and something that that under-18s have to wear when they're batting. And I suppose it's interesting how you have something which is so much cricket kit has become down to fashion and style and corporate branding and everything like that, and the box has completely escaped that. And we all think of it as something that's essential, but not actually as something that, for instance, we want to pay very much money for.
Yeah.
Or something that we sort of pride ourselves on. You know, everyone wants the latest pads, or if not the latest pads, then the most vintage, stylish pads.
Yeah.
But it's something that just completely slipped under that.
It is interesting in that you've sort of painted the kind of the evolution of it, these kind of sort of created in different ways, and sort of all the problems, you know, the initial sort of substance is not working. I mean, it's interesting that it has become so essential. I mean, we were talking before coming on air about the fact that there's something very difficult about the idea of going out to bat without a box.
Yep.
Hardly, you know, you can hardly ever picture those times you've been hit, but yet psychologically it's like a really vital piece
of
equipment.
It is, exactly. Well, I think this idea of whether it is a psychological piece of kit is quite interesting, actually, because people are very, very rarely hit on the box, certainly in international cricket, in Test cricket. The South African opener, Eric Rowan, said that he went out to face the great Australian fast-bowling pair of Lindwall and Miller without a box because it, quote, made him concentrate. Whereas Don Bradman, on the other hand, said that he would never bat without what he described as his confidence producer. So that's just two examples of where...
I think that's probably my favourite of the euphemisms so far. Don Bradman's confidence producer.
Exactly.
It's interesting, isn't it, as well, because you've had this very much with the helmet, where... I certainly think for a while within cricket, it was almost considered sort of not gentlemanly, not sort of the manly thing to do. Mm. You know, if you wear a helmet, it's a bit pathetic. And even now, actually, in a club game, when you see someone rocking in to bat with like a cap on, there's always certain respect for that. You think, you know, well done. Yet that, I don't think that debate happens with the box. You know, I think the decision to go in without a box would be considered deeply...
But it's also just because it's something that you don't... advertised because no one knows if you're actually wearing a box. So you're not actually really saying anything to the world if you're not wearing a box or just being a bloody idiot. So for instance, for Eric Rowan, who batted without one, it was an entirely sort of internal psychological thing rather than a statement, you know, try and hit me in the balls, I bet you can't. So it seems to have escaped this whole psychological battle, sort of slipped in under the radar.
I think it's interesting when you go through the archives, etc., and sort of look back at some of this stuff, and you realise how messy the entire process is, like how these products don't, you know, cricket began and people suddenly thought, ow, this hurts a bit. Yeah, yeah. I need to come up with something that'll protect me. And, you know, this whole sort of messy process of evolution is quite interesting.
So, to the book review, and this week, well, we're not looking at a book, we're looking at the website, Crickinfo.
Very few sports, I think, have such a definitive website that kind of all fans instinctively go to, and Crickinfo is very much that for cricket. We think it is the most popular, unique sporting website in the world, just by sheer numbers of visitors. Its history is quite kind of intriguing because it's kind of grown up with the internet. It was founded in 93, really, at the time the internet was still really in its early phase. Way before mass access to it. And you've also got the fact that it started off as very much a project run by volunteers, really a very small scale thing.
It was a real community thing as well. People pitching in all different kinds of articles. You know, there wasn't a single editorial.
Right,
vision.
And it's obviously
a group of people collaborating.
And its growth, I think, since then has been quite extraordinary. I mean, a lot of it, I guess, its trademark might be said to be the sort of the live ball by ball commentary. Which I think has, for so many cricket fans, just completely changed the way they're able to keep up with games and engage with games.
Yeah, and the number of games that it covers that is amazing, even when it's not actually writing text updates, just doing the ball-by-ball updates.
I find it extraordinary, actually, sometimes. This probably says more about me than about anything else, but I'll occasionally click on the scorecard for a domestic Zimbabwean cricket game, and there will be ball-by-ball, you know, commentary of it.
And I suppose a mark of its success has been the way that it's been taken up by the BBC and by The Guardian, latterly, as well.
It's not maybe a criticism, but I do think one thing that's been interesting is that the BBC and The Guardian have both adopted quite a humorous... they're very heavy on banter, both of them. They do over-by-over rather than ball-by-ball, which allows time for kind of maybe more audience interaction, more sort of funny comments. I feel like Crickinfo, their journalists kind of attempt, maybe in response to the success that the BBC and The Guardian enjoyed that, have attempted to ape it, and it hasn't quite worked.
They're sort of caught between two stools because they kind of want to be sort of authoritative and dry and just giving exactly what's happened. Dravid blocks another ball out. Between doing that and exactly as you say, providing that humour, and sometimes things do get a little bit strained. But still, I would always, and I think it's I don't claim to speak for the majority of cricket fans, but I think it is the case for the majority of cricket fans, would always go there rather than to anywhere else if you wanted.
What I sometimes quite enjoy if I'm really in the mood is having two tabs open. You have Crickinfo to actually know precisely what is going on, and then you have the BBC for something a bit more lighthearted. I kind of, away from the live text commentary, one thing, this is quite a like minority interest feature of the website, but one thing I've always been really impressed with is the fact that Crickinfo does take Test cricket outside the major, international cricket outside the major Test nations quite seriously. It has the excellent Beyond the Test World blog. And I always find this just an endless curiosity. I'll go on and I'll find a snippet on cricket in Malaysia, a bit on Guernsey cricket, a bit on, and it's, you know, it's not vital stuff, but it's nice that a website of its success chooses to give that side of the game such focus.
And it's a sense that you get, I think, across the site as a whole, which is very much designed, a bit like the Guardian site actually, to be browsed rather than to be searched. So when you go onto the front page of Crick Info, you kind of stumble across quite a lot of stuff that you would never even have, you wouldn't know existed, let alone be looking for. And it has so much content that it's built up from so many people, precisely from this community approach that it had from the beginning.
The sheer quantity of the content is astonishing. I mean, I think particularly you've got sort of the core, like, keeping up with current matches, analysis of current matches, and then you've got the Crick Info magazine, which really goes for the more light-hearted stuff, more sort of comment stuff. And you know, it's a very dangerous website for a cricket fan. You quickly find it's a whiling away time. I mean, interesting in terms of Crick Info's history, bought in 2007 by ESPN, and ESPN obviously knew they were on a win, and they haven't. There's been changes, some quite dramatic changes in the presentation. The format has largely been kept, but one thing. Interesting innovation was the introduction of plays of the day, which is a little feature they do at the end of every day of a test match, every one day. The curiosity of this is that it has nothing to do with cricket. Plays of the day comes from ESPN's American football coverage. But what I find really interesting is how well it works. If I haven't been able to keep up with the day's cricket, it's quite often the article I go to. And it's quite brilliant. You often have five moments of the day, and which have been chosen to give a snapshot of the day as a whole. And it's often quite, you know, a very kind of incisive way of looking at a day's play.
That's a really interesting example of how, having been brought up by ESPN, it's sort of drawing in inspiration from lots of ESPN's other sites. Mm. And it'll be interesting to see how it develops, actually, as a site over the coming years. Because you were saying earlier in the podcast about how Kevin Peterson's comments on the IPL sort of went to the top above everything else. And there's a kind of sort of showbiz attitude there, which I think is creeping in slightly, and I think it's reflected also by the fact that some of the feature writing, frankly, is pretty awful. That there's not a sense of, you know, there's not a kind of wisdom, although I think actually wisdom's going in a bad direction at the moment. Can't think of a good example of that. But there doesn't seem to be a dedication to good cricket writing for the sake of good cricket writing. There's always a slight kind of glamour edge to things sometimes.
The problem seems to be is that if you actually look at the list of contributors, it's quite an impressive list.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the regular contributors are not the best, no. You know, are not the really top level cricket
people
writers.
People who are writing the day in, day out stuff.
Yeah. Right, and I think that's the thing. I find that, for me, would be Crick Info's weakness. If I really want sort of good, well-written essays, opinion pieces on cricket, I don't necessarily find it there. I mean, one positive development has been actually in the recent weeks is they seem to have signed Ed Smith on a contract, and he's produced a couple of really good pieces. And it seems to me that the future model, ideally, should actually be kind of like what a lot of the newspapers had for years, where you have established columnists who you know are going to produce a piece on such a day, and I think fans would like that regularity. In terms of innovations, it does seem to make a real push in terms of how it covers county cricket. So they've now got every day of county championship game, they've got a live county cricket vlog.
Yeah, that's really... And I think also the way that they are inviting, I suppose, again, going back to their community-based approach right at the beginning, making a conscious effort to use social media, to use Facebook plugins, for instance, to invite people's comments and debate and things. And inevitably, this means, as always with inviting public feedback on the internet. I mean, most cricket YouTube videos which feature any Indian or Pakistani player just descend into some kind of massive internet.
It's depressing, isn't it? Yeah.
But it will be interesting to see how they can sort of create a kind of sense of an online community around what they're doing as well.
Yeah, well, it has been interesting. I mean, they have had some success interacting with cricket bloggers. So, for example, Jared Kimber's become quite a large feature of the site. Alex Bowden from King Cricket has also writes the odd piece and stuff. But I think, it's a very interesting thing to look at because for all its success, it is something that they're still very much evolving, very much changing. And we'll see what direction it takes.
So, to the debate. And on the back of Essex signing Alvaro Peterson and Somerset taking on Vernon Philander ahead of South Africa's tour of England this summer, we ask whether counties should consider England when choosing their overseas players.
And I remember this debate, I think, first being... Well, I mean, it's been around for a while, but it was a very lively incarnation of this debate when Worcestershire picked up Philip Hughes for the last Ashes here. There's a real sense of, like, well, why should you do this? And I'm very much in the camp that counties do have an obligation to England when they make their overseas signings. And I think, obviously, counties must seek their own success. That's a given, and that's what they're there for. But a successful England team is vital for county cricket. It's vital for cricket's popularity. It's vital for county cricket's finances. I think there's also... It's not clear to me that counties will necessarily lose out from such an arrangement. I mean, I can't believe Alvaro Peterson was the only decent international batsman available to Essex. I feel like maybe they could have... You know, they would have had to have worked harder to find an alternative signing. But I think there were other options out there, and I think it's disappointing, given that there are other options out there, they've chosen to give someone excellent preparation in English conditions ahead of the series. The other thing is that the way this England team has been run has been transformed over the past decade. It's gone from, you know, frankly being very amateur at times to being... You know, there's a level of professionalism under Flower and Strauss that most other test sides are very jealous of, I think. But this is an area that there really hasn't been progress. I mean, I just cannot imagine the domestic teams from another major test nation, Australia, South Africa, giving England players a chance to warm up in their condition. I mean, it's a really odd, almost like sense of fair play thing that we have that I don't necessarily agree with.
I think you've sort of fundamentally misthought the relationship between counties, county cricket and... the English cricket, because absolutely I agree that a successful English side is good for county cricket, but also a successful county setup is good for English cricket. And actually I think it's very good for counties to have foreign players coming in and playing for them. And yes, there's a question about whether people coming in for 2 months is good in the long term, but I think there's an argument to be had both ways on that front. I think as well that actually this idea that counties should do all they can to basically make sure that England has the best chance of winning in the short term looks a little bit like when there are stories from the 50s of England teams going to Australia, and basically the sides there would the grade sides there would basically just bowl bouncers perpetually at the English batsman, because they saw it as their duty to, if they could, injure as many English players as they could.
And make it difficult for them to prepare.
I know you're not saying that, but I think you're not saying they should act negatively to disadvantage the opposition. But actually, I think what's wrong with playing the best possible opposition? And if people have time to acclimatise, why shouldn't you want a sporting endeavour? I don't think it puts a side at a particular disadvantage, but actually, interestingly, when Philip Hughes came before the 2009 Ashes, he went on to have a shocking series. So actually, maybe it's a good idea that they come and play. But just one quick last thing, which is that actually it is genuinely a very good opportunity, particularly in the case of batsmen, and obviously Philander and Peterson aren't, but in the case of batsmen, for English bowlers to have a look at them and to actually people to see how they're going to play in English conditions. And county bowlers, you get a lot of reports of county bowlers going back to the England setup and saying, okay, they were playing this,
It's interesting because I think the Philip Hughes example, that's a fair case where he seemed to get found out actually pretty quick. I mean, some would argue he'd been found out in international cricket already, but he really did seem to get found out very early on in English conditions. I just think while I'm a great believer in the spirit of cricket, et cetera, et cetera, it's right that when we play...
I'm a great believer in God and creation, et cetera, et cetera.
But in the realms of international cricket, I cannot see England's major opponents in international cricket ever considering giving England such an advantage. Like the idea, for example, of English players getting like plenty of time to prepare for an Ashes tour with Australian statesides is improbable. Really, really improbable.
Is that not because it's actually the English players who don't choose to try? Because actually, a lot of English players do spend time in Australia in the winters, in the English winters. And I wonder whether it's actually because we don't have a culture of sending, because we say that we have longer tours so that people can go out there and prepare as a team before then.
I mean, it's an interesting point. I mean, I suppose there's the alternative preparation of, you know, make sure you have enough warm-up games. I mean, coming back to your idea of if there is a choice, this is my feeling, particularly the Essex example. I think Vernon Philander is a really interesting one because, I mean, he's a bowler in extraordinary form. But someone like Elvira Peterson, you know, a solid career, you know, very promising batsman, etc. But if Essex could have found a comparable international batsman from another country, shouldn't they have? You know,
maybe they don't want someone for the entirety of the summer.
So we think they just want someone for the beginning. I just wonder if the choice was there.
If the choice was there, and they could have got a comparable or better international batsman for the entirety of the summer, then surely they would have done.
Mm. I just feel like it's not that, you know, counties should be, for the sake of their fans, for the sake of the health of the game, they should be trying to win games. They should obviously be competing and trying to get as good a foreign players as they can. I think my slight frustration with this is that I think it would be possible for them to do that without necessarily giving England's opponents a sort of subtle advantage in this way.
So you therefore actively discriminate against people who are ever going to play Test cricket in England?
Who are playing Test cricket in England that summer, yes, I think so.
It seems a bit odd to, as a kind of rule, no, you can't come and play to county cricket because there's a possibility that you're going to be selected for Test cricket at some other point during the summer. I just feel uncomfortable with the idea of essentially telling, you know, I mean, so how would you enforce? Is this something you would be enforced?
No, this is the point, I think. So I don't think you could ever enforce it. I think it would be it'd almost be wrong to enforce it. But it would feel slightly Stalinist to tell the counties who they couldn't sign. My feeling is, though, that they owe... there is a relationship between the county. We both agreed this and established this, that counties have an interest in England's success. And many would argue that, you know, particularly certain counties do a fantastic job for England in the way they develop young talent. You know, they fulfil their obligation very clearly. But I think this is one way where counties, without necessarily losing out, could help England.
I think there's such a difference between the development that happens over time by bringing through grassroots players, which happens and is really, really good. But I don't think the county should always just be seen as second, essentially, as support staff to the England team. So absolutely everything that England needs them to do, they then go. There has to come a point where the England side should be good enough to play against people who are acclimatised. They shouldn't need to have sort of the element of, oh no, you can never play on English soil in that summer, because otherwise you're going to have a better chance of beating us than you would if you had. I mean, it just seems an extraordinary assertion to me.
Yeah, but it's the kind of... I mean, I think it's that issue of, if it's going to be a big series like this summer is, it's a battle, you know, another battle for world number one status against the South Africans. You know, it's not wrong that England should seek every possible home advantage. I mean, that's what a home series is about. I mean, I think Vernon Philander...
Every possible home advantage? So you kind of... you know, cover the pitch up and play 11 spinners on the day because it's your
well, we're ranging on to new territory.
Well,
there.
No, I just think that actually it is taking it to a bit of an extreme to say there should be a moral obligation on counties not to give people an opportunity to play in the country prior to that. I mean, it's just sensible preparation.
So Vernon Philander has never had, you know, very exciting new bowler, has never had sort of extensive preparation. English conditions.
Surely
he's about to get that with Somerset.
Yeah, and so part of what being what professional sport about is about, and what professional cricket is about, is actually the preparation for it, and just trying to get in the way of people's preparation. Yeah, absolutely, you should do everything you can to beat an opposition when they're on the field, but trying to do it by getting in the way of their preparation seems to me a bit... I mean, so what do? You ban them from going to the gym when they're in England as well? And tell counties that they can't, you know, counties that they can't...
They can't use the practice nets, yeah?
Their bat tape or something, otherwise they'll be... I mean, it just seems a little bit kind of childish.
I think we've got a collision here between the gentlemanly spirit of cricket and the hard-headed professionalism, in my case, that has served England so well over the last 10 years. Thanks for listening to the 30th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. We'll be back in a couple of weeks where we will be getting very excited about all things county cricket. See you then.